And welcome to the Dark Side of Soul podcast. This is Joe.
This is Sean.
We'd like to welcome you to our lovely little podcast. Our little show is a kind of a spooky evening in spring.
Windy today.
It is windy. Yeah, it's well, you live out in the country. Well, actually, my neighborhood is called Pumudong, which we did some research and found out it means it's really windy here.
Oh, really?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, you got those mountains around, and maybe it makes
we're kind of like next to the we're kind of flatland.
I'm thinking of the train station. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We're kind of in flatland, farmland. We're right near the airport. I mean, not near the airport, but I mean, we're like the last area you can build before there's the airport. There's where the cleared space to keep
right,
and it's flat. And yeah, it does get really windy here, and turns out that's the name of this neighborhood. All right. And today we are going to talk about missing persons. Going back to our true crime series.
Yeah, but focus on missing persons. Yes. Little introduction to what we do, though.
Oh, yes. We run the Dark Side of Soul tours.
Show notes.
Well, you could do it. I could. Yeah, that's fine.
Go ahead.
You had a sexier voice. we run the Dark Side of Soul Ghost Walk 5 days a week, 5 evenings a week. I just did one last night. Lovely group. First one I've done in a while because, you know, we've been closed down because of COVID-19. We opened back up now that social distancing has been relaxed a little bit. Not completely. It's interesting getting back into the swing of it, not having done the tour in a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's changed? It's like a building popped up in the past month. That wasn't there before.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
An entire building.
Where was that?
Like on your roof? Constitutional Court.
Really?
Yeah. There's an annex they had been working on, but they've been working on the foundation. And the last time I saw it, it was still working on foundation. Last night looked pretty much finished. A 3-story building, pretty much finished.
There you go. Up in a day.
Yep. But again, it was spooky. The final stop on our tour, Gyeonggi-gung Palace, was freaked everyone out again. Could have sworn one of our guests swore that saw a woman underneath the lamp.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, we had a question, Sean, the other night. Okay, so we do this thing for where we have Patreon. If you go to darksideofsoul.com/podcast, we have a link to our Patreon page. And for our top tier patrons, we do a monthly hangout on Zoom, and it was fun. We just did that. We just did that recently, and tons of fun. But we were talking to them, but we were given a lot of inside baseball about the tour. And Sean, you had mentioned at Gyeonggi-gung that the bathrooms are closed. They're open. They're open.
Okay.
They're open.
Okay. Okay. During the renovations, last time I was there, I haven't been there in almost 2 months.
Yeah. Oh, the renovations, by the way, it's like a giant mound. It almost looks like an Aztec pyramid. They've dug up so much dirt in front of the palace.
Yeah, that's months now. That must be 4, almost 5 months that they're doing that.
It almost looks like they're doing some type of archaeological thing before they're doing whatever they're planning to do.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah, it looks like, I mean,
bunches.
It was dark, but everything looked kind of laid out in a grid pattern.
That's interesting. Well, they did find things on the grounds there. Because, you know, the Seoul Museum of History is on the grounds that used to be part of the palace grounds. And now the museum curates the palace.
I love that museum.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite museums in Seoul.
It is. The most unsung unsung museum in Seoul.
I think so as well. I go there often. I do a lot of my research at the library there.
It's so good. Yeah. I've gotten a lot of information, a lot of material for the tour from there.
Mm, yeah.
And it's confirmed a lot of material that we've done on the tour.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. For me as well. Like I said, I go to the, when I could, when I was in Seoul. I don't live in Seoul, but whenever I was, I'd probably go to the library at least twice a month.
Mm.
I'd go for a couple of hours. And I just research.
Wow.
Look stuff up.
Ooh, we should go sometime. I've never done that. That sounds so nerdy and so cool.
Yeah.
Also, we have a Facebook page, facebook.com/darksideofseoul, where we regularly do horror movie watch parties. And if you send us a message, you'll talk to Minji the Ghost. And she'll reply to you. It was funny because we did have a guest, the guest that was on last night. She was communicating with us through there, and Minji kept butting into our conversations.
Right.
I explained to her about, sorry, Minji's gonna mess with us for a while.
Do what she wants. Yeah,
she does what she wants.
Yeah,
she's so funny. All right, missing persons. Sean, why don't you start off?
Yeah, well, I think you and I were chatting a bit earlier today, leading up to the episode, to recording, and we both were kind of discussing which cases we're going to talk about and stuff.
Yeah,
and you had mentioned, oh, this is going to be a rough one, and it is. Agree. Yeah,
it's anything that involves hurting, especially as children or anything like that. Yeah. By the way, this, if you're squeamish about missing children and such like that, this is not dead. Wait till our next episode. This is a little, this is one of our darker episodes. Next.
Yeah.
This is an issue. I had a previous marriage, back in the US, and my ex-wife, who later became a police officer, was really obsessed with missing persons. And in the late 90s, I got us a computer and I hooked us up on the internet and introduced her to the internet. And early on, she just got obsessed with missing persons cases. And I had an inkjet printer and she would print up all of these missing people's photos. And she'd be like, you know, you see those conspiracy people posting everything with the yarn, trying to build connections. So she would do that. And our bedroom was just full of pictures of missing people.
Oh, wow.
And I would be in bed some nights and studying or reading a book, and she's on the computer. And then she'll just get up and she'll just take, you know, so she'll tear a photo off the wall and throw it in the trash. And I'm like, well, what's going on? She goes, oh, they found her. She's dead.
Jesus, yeah.
And so, this isn't a very comfortable topic for me, but I think for me personally, I think I need to face certain things that have disturbed me, and I need to face my fears. Before we get started, do want to point out, in Korea, we do have the National Center for Missing Children. It's at missingchild.or.kr. Again, that's missingchild.or.kr. or.kr. They do have an English version of the site. It's helpful to look at.
Well, you just talk about your ex-wife there, and she's saying she'd have a photo up and then she'd throw it away. It's like, oh, they found the person, the person's dead. Korea's probably Korea's most well-known missing persons case, which was a missing persons case for 10 or 11 years, was the Frog Boys. And of course, there's a lot of information. It's within pop culture. There's several songs written about them. At least two movies that I know of. One was made about a year or two after they went missing. They went missing in 91. And the most recent one, which is called Children, which is a good film, is a, maybe almost 10 years ago, maybe 2011 or 2012. But yeah, they were five boys that went missing late March 91, and they were never found. They searched the whole area. They went missing in Daegu, the city of Daegu. And yeah, they had like something, a crazy number, like 300,000 police officers were put on the case to comb the area to look for these five boys. Okay. And they were young. The youngest was like 8 or 9 years old. And the I think the oldest was about maybe 13, just entering his teenage years. And they went off into the mountains to the search for salamander eggs. Now, they called them the frog boys. And I, from what I recall, they're called that because some earlier report mentioned they were looking for frog eggs. Mm-hmm. So they got the name the frog boys, but they were actually looking for salamander eggs. I think that's where it comes from. Don't quote me on that. But I seem to remember that from years and years ago when I first heard about the case. Anyway, yeah, they were never found. And then in 2002, they found their remains. And yeah, I was in Korea at the time. So I remember this when it was on all over the news. And this is the first time I heard of it. And then I really started looking into it. They found their remains. At least, I think two or three of them were found to have blunt force trauma on their skull. So their heads were head damage was very likely the cause of death. But the police tried to say that it was they died of hypothermia. They got lost and things like that. And most people just didn't believe it. Now, a few years ago, I met a woman, an older woman who is very close friends with one of the investigators on the case initially, one of the initial investigators. I'm not going to say his position or anything like that, or his name, but he was part of the initial investigation, pretty high up on the team of investigators. And he put forward the idea in 91 when they were searching for the boys that they should turn it into a homicide case. And he was told to never bring that up again and don't mention it to the media. And he was threatened possibly with his job to not bring up the idea that those five boys were murdered. But when they found the remains in 2002, they very likely were. So
that's, they say this is a pattern, and this is why I want to do this, to make me feel, to help me with this is a lot of, I wouldn't say police, well, maybe police incompetence, police complacency,
poor policy
and politics over doing their job.
Yeah.
We've seen that quite a lot. I remember when Lee Myung-bak, former president of Korea, when he first came into office, this is how he first made his name. And I think it was the highest his poll numbers ever were. I think someone tried to attack a girl, and they had the CCTV footage, and I think it was in an elevator. And the police were being very slow, and they were being complacent, and they didn't really do anything to catch the guy. And then Lee Myung-bak went in there and just ripped him a new one, and they went and got him.
Oh wow! Yeah, yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, the policies have changed a lot. I'm not entirely certain about the policies, but I know they've gotten better.
Yeah.
And
sexual assault, they have.
Yes. And the policies regarding missing children. And I'll talk about that a little bit more with the case that I'm going to talk about tonight. But it's good that these things change. I think it was around 2005, maybe, when the policies really changed and became strict. and the cops have to look for a reportedly missing child immediately. They can't put it off. Korea has annually almost 40,000 missing children a year.
Wow.
Now that number is a little bit deceptive as well, because it's deceiving, I should say, because it also includes people with dementia or with certain disorders that they could be adults physically, but mentally their age is quite young. Say they're like a child, like a 10-year-old or something like that. So it does include people like that as well. They're categorized. If they're missing, they're categorized as missing children. So, it's almost 40,000. And the numbers in the last several years of the children who are missing, who are never found, has continually been increasing. So, which is unfortunate. But still, the number is quite not that high. It's fewer than 200. But that's fewer than 200 children a year who go missing, who never get found. So, but compared to the number of 40,000 that are reported missing, that's quite good. And it could be because the policies and the laws got better. Okay. So a lot of different things happened, different cases. I think the Frog Boys case may have had something to do with that. And yeah, the case that I'm going to talk about, the missing persons case that I'm most intrigued by in Korea is a 17-year-old girl named Song Hae-hee. And she went missing on February 13th, 1999. She was out with some friends, doing what teenagers do. And she made her way back home. Now, she was from Pyeongtaek. Now, Pyeongtaek is, a very, especially more than 20 years ago in the 90s, Pyeongtaek was mostly farming. It's a lot of agriculture in that area. Ah. So she took the regular, they call them the Mao bus, some of the village buses, to go home. She got off the bus at around 10 p.m. and the bus driver knew most of his regular passengers and he recognized Hae-hee. And when she got off the bus, he said goodnight to her. And the bus driver reported when he was interviewed later that there a man also got off the bus at the same time, but the driver didn't know who this man was. Mm-hmm. But allegedly, the driver said he stunk of booze, he smelled of alcohol, he seemed drunk. Now, the way it was described is that when Hae-hee had to get off the bus at her stop, she had to walk up a little bit and go up through a dark alley towards her house, and she lived on a farm. Her parents raised cattle of some sort. Mm-hmm. The driver said the man followed her up through that dark alley. And that was the last time anyone ever saw her. So what's significant about the case and what I was just talking about, how policy has changed, is that when Hae-hee didn't arrive home at around 11 o'clock that night, her father went out looking for her. And now his name is Song Gil-yong, and that's important because I'm going to talk about him a little bit more, the father. He went looking for his daughter, found no trace of her, and then called the police early in the morning. It would have been the next morning on the 14th, and reported his daughter missing. The police didn't start looking for her until 3 days later. And the excuse that they gave was it was the Lunar New Year holiday.
Oh, my.
So policy change has been put into place to make sure something of that never happens again. It's known through statistically and through research that the first 48 hours of a child being missing are the most crucial. Once you go beyond the 48-hour period, the chances of finding those children alive or at all starts to diminish pretty quickly. So they didn't start looking for her more than 72 hours later, after she was reported missing. when they finally did start looking for her, they found no trace. no trace of either her or of the man.
Mm-hmm.
And they searched for her for some time, and it just, they found no evidence. They found nothing. And that was it. There was nothing more they could do. And then from there on, her father and her mother, Hehe's father and mother, started looking for her themselves. They started their own investigations. They quit their jobs, bought a truck, or maybe they had a truck before, but they started living out of their truck, driving around the country, putting up these banners with photos. Usually it's one or two photos of Hehe, and then asking people for help to find Song Hehe. They give her details, like her height and her weight and what she was wearing, things like that. Last time she was seen and in the Pyeongtaek area. And they drove all around Korea doing this, doing their own investigation and whatnot. Never found her. They lived pretty poor means. They stopped, they left their farm essentially, gave up whatever other work they would have had. Devoted all their time and money to looking for Hehe, their youngest daughter. There's an older, Hehe had an older sister. And they did that for several years, almost 4 years, living off of ramyeon, cup noodles, soju, because soju is cheaper than water, especially in those days. And these days, I'm not really sure if it is. But back then, when I first came to Korea in the year 2000, soju was cheaper than water. So to save money, they would just buy booze. It was cheaper than water. So in 2003, sadly, Hehe's mother committed suicide. She wrapped herself in the banners that they were hanging to help to give people notification that they're looking for their daughter. She wrapped herself in a few of those banners, held the photo of Hehe to her chest, and she overdosed on pills. Mm. And she was found by her husband, Kil Yong, Mr. Song. And from then on, Mr. Song has been looking for Hehe himself. And he's hardly stopped. Some of the other things that he's gone through, he's continued to not really have a job. He just investigates on his own. He travels the country still in his little truck, and he still puts up banners looking for Hehe. And since he doesn't work, he does get government assistance every month. He gets about 500,000 won from the government, and that's it. So that's roughly $500. Mm-hmm. He spends 300,000 won of that, of roughly $300, on producing the banners and the flyers looking for his daughter. And he spends the rest of his money on his rent, which is pretty low. Apparently he lives in a pretty ramshackle kind of place in Pyeongtaek. And he lives mostly off of food that's sent to his residence every day. And that's sent to him from the government. It's just basically basic rice and some other, the panchan, the side dishes, the Koreans eat, bits of vegetables and things like that, kimchi. And despite going through all of this, he has been the victim of a lot of pranks as well. Over the years, people have called him, claimed to be the person who kidnapped Hehe, demanding money, let me say millions of won, some thousands of dollars, and he would pay it, and it turned out it was just a ruse. Someone was just tricking him to get money out of him. They had nothing to do with Hehe's disappearance at all. Other times, people would call him and say, hey, he is in a certain location, and he'd go and, you know, go and look for her. Then he'd find out that that was a prank as well. She was never there. People were just being complete assholes.
Yeah.
Tricking the poor man. His health has gotten really bad. I know in 2017, he, he had an accident. He was hanging one of the banners, the Hey He banners, and he fell and he hurt his back. And so he was in the hospital for some time. And I don't really know how active he has been since 2017. And I'm not exactly sure if he's still alive. But recently, I've seen the banners again. And so, of course, recently, I've just been in semi-isolation back home. But in mid to late January, I saw a couple of the banners hanging in Kwanghwamun. So okay. Right at the main intersection, the Kwanghwamun Square and forever. And that's pretty much central Seoul, the main areas of Seoul. And then early February, and I took a photo of this one, so I know the date exactly. It was February 5th. There was a banner in Uljiro, near Uljiro Iga, the subway station, Uljiro 2. So either he or someone else is continuing to hang these banners.
Yeah, there's one that we've passed by on my tour, right over the Cheonggyecheon on
the bridge.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, near Samyeolo. Yeah.
Yes, right. Sometimes I'm pretty sure hanging the banners is illegal. He's not allowed to do it technically, but I noticed that often, compared to other banners, they stay up for a long time.
They do. I just don't think they have the heart to take it down.
I think that's it. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's
what it is. That's one thing this frustrates people about Korea, but I also think is part of the charm of Korea is rules aren't treated like a computer where it's just zeros and ones. It's binary. You either break the law or you don't. They're guidelines in the sense that the authorities kind of look at the humanity of the situation and put that into account before they do things like take down banners,
I agree. I'm pretty sure that's it. I think they're like, okay, just leave it up. It's not hurting anyone. It's not a political thing. He's not trying to sell something. No. He's not trying to take advertising space or anything like that. He's looking for his little girl. The really sad thing, he keeps doing this, but the statute of limitations on Heihee's case expired in 2014. Mm-hmm. So even if they find a person responsible for her disappearance, there's nothing they can do. Mm. So, but he doesn't stop. He doesn't care. He wants to find out what happened to her.
What happened. Yeah.
So, yeah, he has a pretty, he did an interview in 2017 and, he had a pretty, heart-wrenching quote. I'll read it. This is actually two quotes together. He just said, "I wish I'd given her everything she ever wanted. Sometimes when I wake up in the morning, I check to see if she came back. I long for her every moment of my life." So that's how he's spending the rest of his life, looking for his little girl.
I know that feeling. I can understand that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. So especially any parent, for sure.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, not only parents, like a child whose parent is missing, you know, you can definitely connect to the pain that he's feeling if someone that you absolutely love is gone and you don't know what happened. Don't have that closure.
Don't have the closure.
The mystery of it is the big problem. So in terms of policy, with her case reaching its statute of limitations in 2014, I think the policy change that's being discussed, or maybe it's already happened, I'm not entirely sure. Excuse me. the policy change is to remove statute of limitations for children, people 18 and younger who are missing.
Mm.
So Korea used to have a statute of limitations on murder, if you recall, and they finally got rid of that. There is no longer a statute of limitations. on murder, but it isn't retroactive. They recently caught the Hwasong killer, but he can't be tried because the statute of limitations on his murders in the late 80s, early 90s is expired.
Hmm.
So any murders going forward, I think they changed it. I think that was around 2015. Don't quote me on that either. I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, so a lot of policies have been under review and have changed regarding missing children because of both the Frog Boys case, especially after their bodies were discovered in 2002, and because of Song Hye-hee. So,
thank you. Yeah, that's one story that is heart-wrenching. I remember Korea Exposé did an article about the father.
That's right. That's where I got that quote from. And I'm glad that was done. That Korea Exposé article was written by a teenager.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, Korea Exposé. I don't think they're active anymore, but they had some really great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really, really, really stuff that really slipped under the cracks.
Right. Yeah, it was because of the Frog Boys that I got interested in all these other missing persons cases. And then that's when I discovered Song Hye-hee. And then, I got a bit of the update when Korea Exposé did their article a couple of years ago. Mm.
Yeah, it's, my experience with my ex-wife, I'm concerned, but I don't talk about it with other people. That's what it is. I just keep it to myself. And I just meditate. Yeah. So, this is what I have is, from around 2005 to 2014, I lived in Anyang. And I remember one of my first years there. It's actually the first year my wife and I were living with each other, living together. And I remembered the winter of 2007, 2008, all these banners around with these pictures of these two young girls. And I was wondering what's going on. Cause back then my Korean was really bad. And my wife explained that they were missing. They were looking for them. And these banners were up for so long, it felt like. And basically it was this, it was December. It was Christmas Day, 2007. These two girls, Lee Hye-jin and Oh Ye-sul, they were walking home from playing and they disappeared. The last time they were seen was near the Anyang Arts Center, which is right in downtown Anyang, around 4:10 p.m. CCTV got them. So the short of it is their bodies were found months later, 77 days later. One was found in a mountain near Suwon, and they were able to track it down to a 39-year-old man named Jung Song Hyun. And this is where it gets, I don't know, this is where I just started going into this rabbit hole, re-researching this, because I remember the pictures, you just saw them everywhere. And so they were always present in your mind. And this is just all over again. Me, just those days with my ex-wife is seeing these faces all the time. And then finding out that they're no longer with us. It just put me in a rut. And this is why I'm doing this now, is to help me just kind of work through my feelings about this. And I wanted to know what happened. This is my excuse to just go back and find out what happened after that. I knew they found the girls and they caught someone, but then now they went through and they investigated more details about what happened. I won't go into too much into the really nasty stuff, but they ended up finding him. He was on the run, and they arrested him at his mother's house in Boyong in South Chungcheong Province. They brought him in to try to get a confession out of him. At first, he said that he'd hit them in a car accident, even though he didn't own a car.
Then finally it came through. And so he'd been drinking all day, and then he was huffing. He was inhaling stuff. And so he was high, and he left home to buy cigarettes, and he saw the girls and he kidnapped them, assaulted them, and then murdered them. And what he did was he murdered them after he sobered up and saw what he had done. Yeah, I know the logic of that. This is what he did, though. He rented a car and put them in the trunk and disposed of the bodies in Suwon and Sihung at Gunja Stream. They were searching for these girls for so long. And the reason he was picked up, now this is where it is really, it goes into the problems with the police, was they were kind of just sitting on this. They were being complacent. There was a whistleblower who had sent an email to the media, someone who had been working on the case on the inside, and saying that he was this number one suspect because he had a history. He was suspected of a murder of another woman back in 2004. But it was released for lack of evidence. They questioned him three times and let him go because he had this alibi that he was like a volunteer driver, like one of those guys that drives people's cars whenever they're drunk.
Daddy Eunjun.
Yeah. But the thing was, they never checked with his employer to see if that was true. They just let him go. Jesus. And it's, oh, okay. Oh, that's where you were? Okay, okay. But yeah, so at the time when the girls were missing, and he lived right near where they lived, he himself was not seen for 5 days. So he was a suspect, and they didn't cross check with the employer. They went and checked his apartment. They didn't find any blood evidence or anything. And then a new commissioner came in and kind of restarted the case. Didn't reopen it because it was still open, but restarted it. Started all over from the beginning. And he had the idea of looking at car rental records from the day they went missing. And they went, and sure enough, they saw blood stains in the trunk of a sedan, and connected it to the girls, connected it to him because it was his name that rented the car. Arrested him, brought him in, finally booked him. But this exposed a lot of problems with the police at the time. They were not checking everything thoroughly. Also, the other different offices all over Gyeonggi Province were not communicating well. They weren't opening everything. So this resulted in creating a nationwide data sharing system. I remember that. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
And that was even though we say a lot of bad things about former President Lee Myung-bak, I think he was behind a lot of that. So yeah, in the end, he led them to where the girls were buried, and he received the death penalty in 2009. And as far as we know, currently in prison.
Yeah, right now. The last execution was in 97, I think.
Yeah,
that's on. Still technically exists, but the death penalty, but it's kind of frozen. It's on hold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the picture of those girls are still just burned in my head. And
yeah,
I tell you this, after researching this today, researching and my daughter Gian was outside playing. She usually just plays right in front of, and there's this courtyard and right outside our balcony. And I just had to go straight to the balcony and make sure that she was okay.
Yeah.
And then I ate some soup for lunch, and I went back out to the balcony, and I couldn't find her.
And she says, oh, my wife says, oh, she just walked off with her friend. I'm like, does she have her phone? She goes, yeah, I think so. And I called Gian on the phone. She's like, what, Daddy? I'm like, just sit if you're okay.
Cramping my style, Dad.
Yeah, Dad. I just got worried.
You know it gets serious if she calls you Joe. What do you want, Joe?
Yeah. A little but annoyed with me calling her.
Yeah. And I think that's something that has brought up something I think that I think about now and again. And I get asked this. There's been just a couple of times. It doesn't happen often, but people say at least twice. I don't know if this has happened to you, Joe, but I've been slightly criticized once severely, and another time just out of kind of honest curiosity for the content we discussed on the tour.
Oh,
I was criticized by not by someone on the tour, because anyone who's doing the tour should know what the content generally is going to be. The people are like, how can you be interested in this kind of thing? And I think there's a really logical answer to that. I'd be interested in your response as well, mm-hmm. and anyone else's response if they want to comment on the video after. I think it's good. Let's just talk about missing children. I think it's good for us to know what these cases are, mm-hmm. because I think it can help to create a sense of awareness, being a little bit more conscious of keeping our children safe. But then, you know, we have to find that balance. We can't be helicopter parents either.
Yeah, we have to keep the balance.
So,
yeah.
So, but I think, you know, you can be a little bit more aware. And I do think knowing these things, understanding that monsters are real, you know, they're creeping in dark places, but they're not vampires and werewolves and Chukchin and Japgui, things like that. They're real and they're people. And I think by studying cases like this, it's no indication, there's nothing talking about our personality that we're warped or dark. But I think it's an interest that leads to a greater awareness of the dangers that exist.
Yeah.
And it helps us to prepare.
Prepare and celebrate life as we still have it. The older I get, the more sensitive I am about that, especially as a parent. Mm. You know, I don't even like to kill a bug. If there's a bug in the house, I take it outside. My wife criticizes me because I take it outside. Or even when I have to flush it down the toilet, I'm like, I hope you swim. I hope you can swim.
You're right. Right.
Like that. And there are times I've actually gone, you know, I lean a little more vegetarian than I used to be because I'm just, have a little more compassion for life. And this kind of, for me in a way, this honors their memory a bit, even though I did talk about some bad details and I talked about bodies and corpses. But I mean, to me, I still feel like those are my kids.
Yeah.
I never had really closure about that case. And it really was bothering me. And now my ex-wife, she did take it to the extreme. And we're friends now, but she talks back and says, with the kids that we had, she was a little too protective of them because
find that balance.
Had a hard, my oldest had a little hard time learning how to live on his own because he was protected so much. But then again, my middle child, my daughter, she's now 23. But a few years ago, she was a clerk at a candy store, and a man came in with an aluminum baseball bat, and he was hitting things with the baseball bat and was threatening her. Mm-hmm. And he was about to get her, And thanks to her mother teaching her about self-defense, she whipped out that pepper spray and
nice.
chased him out of the store. I saw the CCTV.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it helps people to prepare for situations like that. Yeah. Related to that, people often will ask, you know, other people why they like horror films. Like why?
Yeah. Why do you like horror films, Sean?
Why do you like horror films? Because they think it's, you're warped or demented or there's something, again, you have a personality disorder of some sort. That's why you like horror films. Like you're a sadist and whatever. Stephen King did have a really good answer to that a long time ago. And I think this is in his book, Dance Macabre, which was perhaps his first nonfiction book. I think 1980, 1981, right around the time. I think after, maybe earlier, after he wrote The Shining. He was still cooking up. Yep, absolutely. His response to that question was, seeing tragedy in a horror film, and I'm paraphrasing, seeing tragedy in a horror film helps us to prepare for tragedy in real life.
Yeah.
Helps us to mentally kind of get ready for that. And that's worked for me. I think you know a certain tragedy that I had in my life several years ago. And I'll just say it. I'm a bereaved parent. My eldest daughter passed away several years ago. So yeah, there was a certain level of that. I know I'm not over that at all.
No.
And I don't think I ever will be.
No.
But there was a certain level of preparedness. It's hard to explain. But there was a certain level of preparedness I had, and I think that came from horror fiction, and I will say Superman. Superman was my first love within the comics book medium. I think there's a lot to be said about learning about things like true crime. That helps us to prepare for any tragedies that we may face ourselves in the future.
It's tough because the older you get, the more experience you have and the less.
Right.
I see. I don't know. I think some people, when they get older, they get more jaded. I get less jaded. It feels like adolescence is when you're at peak jadedness. You know?
Yeah, right.
You just look at everything with a cocky point of view. You're invincible.
Yeah.
And you see death happening to people, bad things happening, and you laugh at it.
Mm.
This is one disturbing. Okay. This is not related to the show, but this is a disturbing thing that really bugged me. Cause I worked for a TV station in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And most all of us at the TV station were communications majors. We were all students at the University of Alabama. But I was a non-traditional student. I was maybe 4 or 5 years older than most of the other guys working at the station and the crew.
Mm-hmm.
That one day I came in and we get these live satellite feeds. This is back in 1990, late 90s. We get these live satellite feeds. And back then it's hard. We didn't have live Twitter, live internet to get all this stuff. And so we were getting this live unedited feed of Columbine as it was happening.
Oh my. Yeah.
And it was horrific. Mm. And I was sitting there just shocked and looking at it, but there were two guys looking at that and they were treating it like it was an action film. They were laughing at it.
That's madness.
Yeah. And that disturbed me. Their reaction really disturbed me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah. That's ineffable. Don't even really know how to comment on that.
Yeah. Well, they would really regularly do stuff. They would play a prank on the news anchors right before a show. And they would throw on the monitors faces of death. Yeah. They would do stuff like that.
I see. Yeah. A bit warped.
Yeah, that's a little adolescent warpness. Anyway,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is why we do this: is to face face mortality, face the unknown, and face tragedy. I mean, we've gone through it in Korea with the Sewol. Sewol was really Sewol still just
very raw.
And I my first year was in Ansan, where most of those students were, and I still will never know if any of those students on that boat were some of my former students. I will never know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, thank you.
Just at the anniversary. Yeah.
Yeah. If you've gone through this, thank you for sharing this time with us. That really means a lot, because I think Sean and I are kind of bearing our souls right now because we're not doing therapy at the moment. So this is it.
Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. And we're stuck inside in semi-isolation.
Yeah. Isolation. And yeah.
Gotta talk to someone.
Yeah, I gotta talk to someone. But if you're willing to help pay for our therapy bills,
become a patron.
Become a patron on Patreon.
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to thank our top tier patrons, Angel Earl, Joel Bonamini. I meant to ask you, Joel, how to pronounce your name on Friday. Jamie Staley and Sharon Cullen. Really fun talking to you guys the other time. We've now hit $100 a month on our
yes.
Our goal is 200 a month, and once we get that, we're able to put out more content for everyone. We have lots of content for our patrons, so this isn't just you're not just putting money in a tip jar. You actually get stuff.
Yeah, you're paying us to work.
Yeah, we have a lot of extra content that we give you that it's kind of like the soul. That's Soul Podcast. That's my other podcast, Soul Podcast.
Soul Podcast.
Soul Podcast. Dark Side Podcast. This is just one of many media we are producing right now. We have available for you. We also have Weird Tales from Korean Lore. I got it right that time.
There you go. Yep. That's my audio series.
Very popular. And we also have music by Sorak-san, who does our opening and closing. And this is interesting, as I kind of thought in the back of my head, the music that we have from Sorak-san, it's Korean music that he's kind of made into ambient.
Yeah, it's a sample. Yeah.
Yeah. I think
we were talking before, we're going to have him on as a guest.
Yeah,
on a future episode to kind of talk about his.
Because yeah. I was showing my wife the podcast and the opening song, and she's like, "Oh, that's a Korean song." I'm like, "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah." Mm-hmm. And then today I was getting ready and I have my playlist going, and one of Ed's Sorak-san's songs was playing on the playlist, and it was like a slowed down trot song.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, oh. Yeah. He does a lot of interesting stuff. Yeah,
yeah. It's like it was lyrics are, and you could tell the person was singing Korean. It's kind of haunting. This is haunting Korean music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you get you'll get free track every month by being a mid-tier patron.
Yes.
Also, point out we do run our tours. You can book our tours. We're running them. Excuse me. We're running them again. DarkSideOfSoul.com. I am running a COVID-19 discount right now. So,
Well, that's right. Yes.
Yeah, check that out. I think it's the coupon code COVID-19, and you get a discount.
If you book on the site.
Yeah. Yeah. Through the site. At this point, I mean, we're kind of because of the way things are right now, and we're loosening up the restrictions a bit. If you are living in Korea, especially if you're in the Seoul area, we will even put together a tour with your friends. Yeah. Just get your friends together and contact us and say, "Hey, I'd like to do a tour," and we'll hook you up. We'll see what we can do. We'll see what we can do. That's what I did last night. It was four people. And
right.
We'll do that for you. Well, anyway, thank you everyone for listening, staying with us. Thank you for our patrons. Until next time, stay spooky.
Thanks. Good night.